Greatest lesson Mr. Polk taught me is patience.
You've been pretty much, I had to drive all the way out to California to get you from your...
from the biker gang that held me hostage.
it was quite a debacle.
Mm. Well, all Sons of Anarchy related things often are. Okay, so shall we welcome everybody to the second episode of the TV.net Flashcast for Sons of Anarchy. This is the Flashcast episode for Season 7, Episode 2. I believe it was called Toil and Trouble.
It was indeed.
Mm-hmm. And I am Lisa Schmeiser here, as always, with Philip Mozeliak. And we are going to be talking about preschool curricula tonight.
That's right. and story writing at mm-hmm. its slowest.
Yes, at a glacial pace. But you know what's not at a glacial pace? This podcast. What I'm going to do is cue up the timer on my computer to see if I can recap Sons of Anarchy for you, if I can recap a 90-minute episode in a minute or less, and then Philip and I will spend the next, 28, 29 minutes?
Sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll spend the next half hour or a little bit less talking about this show because we know how to edit. Anyway, shall I start the recap?
Do it. Start your timer.
All right, starting now. This episode contains a lot of furniture moving and or chessboard setting up, depending on your metaphor. The relationship between Gemma and Tara continues unabated. It doesn't matter that Tara is at this point because Gemma is still having an incredibly emotional relationship with the woman she once called her daughter. She's filled with regret over killing Tara, a move she expresses to Abel obliquely, and she freaks out when she realizes that Unser has been appointed to the sheriff's office as a consultant to help solve the murder. Unser survived his showdown with Juice in Wendy's apartment, but now that Gemma knows that he's working for the cops, she tries to get Juice to go out of town. Juice does. Next week's preview, however, suggests that he may be gone, but he doesn't go that far. Or he comes back. He's kind of not very bright. Anyway, the main point is tonight Jax makes a whole bunch of really dumb moves because he's still under the impression that the Chinese are the ones who kill his wife. And two of the people he kills are people who are close to Jury, and that's going to come back to bite Jax on the rear end. It has been a minute. There we go.
The only thing that I think you missed was Nero.
Oh, I did miss Nero. That's right. One of the best scenes, too, because it was Nero and Wendy in the car together.
And it was almost a direct mirror of when Jax was in the car with Nero first meeting him.
Yes. Yes, you're right, because Nero was, once again, dropping the wisdom about how he's kind of a family man and just trying to keep it real every day.
And talk, and he even said, he slipped up and he said, yeah, my junky wife, which is exactly, you know, kind of contrapositive of that that episode where they were in the truck.
Well, this raises a fascinating question. Do you think that Nero is all talk and no walk, or do you think that this parallel is intentional to show that that there's still a chance for Nero to get out of the life so long as he just keeps it to a paternal role?
I think he believes that he is the politician. Mm-hmm. He's trying to do everything he can. Mm-hmm. And he says, when I think about my son.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, I think this is going to be a bad news scenario.
Yeah. Well, look at who he's dating.
Well, that's right. Everybody that she's with dies.
I know. It's the most effective breakup strategy ever. You never have to worry about the awkward conversation when you go to get your stuff back.
No.
Because you can just take what you want during the funeral. Ha ha. But let's talk Nero for a minute, just because he seems to be trying really hard to be the moral compass for this group of bikers. And he also seems to be trying to play that role with both Borowski and Alvarez. Because one of my other favorite scenes with Nero that I also left out in my one-minute recap was when they have the sit-down with Borowski, and Borowski starts getting high and mighty about people's jackets. And Nero reminds him that, you know, look, you're a dirty cop. This is why you're here in the first place.
And this is the second time that he's had to kind of put into check the Mayans and what they – I mean, they've said their plan now basically twice.
Yeah.
That they know that Borowski's eventually going to soak them for a little bit more money. and then they'll whack him.
Yeah.
And it seems as though he's trying to keep the peace.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, does it seem kind of awkward that he's like seems to be really good with Jax now? Like when at the end of season six,
they were really at loggerheads and it looked like Jax was ready to kill him.
Right.
I have my own. Okay. So I have a crazy theory about this here, about this season in general. And I think you and I may have tweeted a bit about this, where my theory was that season six was kind of the mirror image of season one, because you had a lot of very similar arcs, especially with a biker who was genuinely conflicted about his obligations towards the club and his wife who wanted out of the life or who was pulling away from him. You had law enforcement that was driving a wedge between the couple, and then the wife dies at the end. In season one, it was Opie and Donna. And then Opie spins off the rails until he's killed in like season five.
Yep.
And in season six, the parallel was with Jax and Tara, where Tara is effectively duplicating all of Donna Winston's actions from season one. I thought there were really strong parallels. I'm wondering if this season is paralleling season two, because you remember that was the season where you saw that other gangs and organizations were much more disciplined and much smarter than the Suns tend to be. And Gemma starts off that season with some profound damage that she chooses not to address in a productive manner because of her own misguided sense of priorities. And ultimately, her avoidance of an issue damages her family relationships and tears apart the club on some level. And Jax kind of stumbles around that entire season, just kind of lost and confused and all, what the hell is going on? Until, you know, the final episode where they do this godfather-like plan. There's a federal deus ex machina that lets the, I can't remember his name, the Adamarkin character off the hook. But I'm wondering if we're going to see that arc play out again this year, too, because it seems like all of the signs are there. And this is where I get crazy and tin-hatty, I seriously think Rad is a Fed. And I think he's going to be the deus ex machina in the back third of the season.
It's very possible. And it's funny now that you've mentioned this, because now something occurred to me. Because, well, Marilyn Manson's character is the head of the third guy in line with white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
And all of season two, what was that about? White supremacist.
It was a two-arm operation, though, because you remember there was I'm not clear on the names anymore because it's been a while. It's not my favorite season to rewatch, but there was like the Henry Rollins arm, and then there was the Darby arm, and they weren't exactly cool with each other, if right. I remember correctly.
Yeah, Darby was the Nords, and Marilyn Manson says explicitly that you know those guys aren't even legit.
Yeah, and from what I suspect, we're about to see a power struggle in the Grim Bastards too. So it's going to be the same thing all over again, where you have people who have a loose adherent who should have stuff in common and don't. I think we're going to see a mirror of season two, which frankly was a terrible season that had a gut punch ending.
Right. I had said this, I think, a couple times on Twitter. In fact, I know I did. And then Tony Sindelar jumped right in.
Yeah.
But this episode is so move. Slow. It moves like The Walking Dead, and I really like The Walking Dead, but it's this enormous buildup, and it seems like nothing happened, but the only problem I have is there's some really bad writing in here that really like where Nero is basically speaking his motivations out.
Oh, learn to edit, Sutter. Well, Nero has the one quote of the week. If I stay in truth and I give it to people straight, no lies, no fools, no games, I always know that whatever happens, I did the right thing, whether I like it or not. And like I said, you pause the DVR, wait for the hail of foreshadowing anvils to subside, watch it again. I feel like this was the week where you had a lot of characters turn to the camera and say, here is my motivation for the rest of the season. Here is my motivation. And it's almost insulting because season seven, this is not, everybody's caught up on season one through six. Either they caught up on Netflix or they caught up on iTunes or they've been watching it all along. Nobody is coming into season seven of Sons of Anarchy all, so guys, what's happened?
Right.
And so I find it kind of insulting that everybody is laying out, some people are very, very verbal about their motives. I have also noticed that Kurt Sutter is a very good storyteller in many respects, but one of the things he almost always does at the beginning of every season of this freaking show is he has one or two episodes where it's nothing but putting the chess pieces into place and telegraphing what's going to happen. And that makes the back half of this of any season really satisfying, because you're like, ooh, I've been waiting for this for six episodes. But it can be tedious while it's being set up. Like the Tara faked miscarriage storyline last year had that same really long, dragged out setup. And then it was over, like the whole thing was over in like an episode and a half. And you're like, wait, what? What? We had six episodes to build up to this? And so I feel like we're going to have that here too.
And here again, I got to say, you know, Juice figures, you know, finds Unser, puts him into the bathtub. They chat for a little bit, and he lets him go.
Juice should have killed him.
It only makes sense.
We know that Juice, he's never been the smartest, and he's always been a weak link in the club. Always, 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 always. And I think Ruse, and I was thinking about this on the ferry home, because I knew we were going to talk about it tonight. You know, Roosevelt picked correctly when he picked Juice to lean on him, because he knew, again, correctly, that Juice was the big weak link in the club. And it's not because Juice was half black and hiding his origin. It was because Juice there's no there, for lack of a better word. Like he's intrinsically weak as a character. You know, that's just his character flaw. He buckles to the biggest bitch in the room.
And see here, then again, you bring up Rat Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost don't like to hear him talk very much. I almost preferred him as
silent.
Or as a prospect instead. Yeah. You know, pushing him up into like now he's buddy buddy with Tiggs.
I thought that was an interesting dynamic.
It was, but
because it's almost father son, and one of the themes that carries out through this show all the time is how everybody is looking for a father figure.
Yep. Okay, I could see that. But the only problem I had with it is, mm-hmm. if this is the start of it, I can buy into that, but they were just too buddy-buddy. It's like, I wasn't ready for that. I wasn't ready for them just to be so kind mm-hmm. of, well, here, let me, I'm going to put my head in, or I'm going to put my head in my lap right now.
Well, Tig's always giving the prospects and the newbies a hard time, and that was something that came out a lot more in season one especially, which I think... you and I haven't gone through and ranked the seasons yet, but I'm going to make the argument that season one is in the top 2 to 3 for the series. And in season one, you saw the younger guys being given a ration of shit a lot. And, or a ration of poop, excuse me. And, this was one of the ways that you actually showed that Jax was slightly different was he still got it, but not as hard. Whereas Opie kind of got, you know, harassed by all the guys, all the prospects did. I mean, remember they used to just say terrible things too and about Filthy Phil.
Yes.
So it's not out of club trait for there to be that verbal haranguing. And what I'm wondering is if the motivation that Kim Coates and Nico, whatever his last name, Nocera, there's a T in there somewhere. Anyway, what I'm wondering is if the actors went to that saying, okay, the backstory for these guys now is they've had this experience, the shootout at the racist ranch, that's bonded them. And so now Tig is more comfortable giving this guy harassment, you know, and calling it club culture or club hazing or whatever. And Rat Boy is more comfortable taking it because now that he's fully patched in, he can have some more give and take the way he wouldn't as a prospect.
Yeah.
I mean, I see where you mean where to us it seems a little weird and unearned, but I think that the actors are going into this with a backstory and a history that we have to kind of figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a point at which I got to accept that maybe this didn't – I don't see it. But,
yeah.
But that's not good either because it's like I'm inferring a relationship that I really haven't seen before.
Yeah. No, I think – well, let's see. They used to give Filthy Phil a hugely hard time. They never gave Velen a hard time at all. And to be honest, I never understood why he was there. They used to give Half Sack a big hard time, too.
Well, until he actually what was it? Did he really do a murder or something like that? I can't remember what it was, but he's in prison for reals.
No, the Half Sack, he died. He killed his landlady and died.
Oh,
and then kill himself. Yeah, it's horrible. It was a terrible story, terrible ending to it.
Ugh.
Yeah, excuse me. But yeah, the actor wanted off of the show. And Kurt Sutter has always been very, very vocal about, no, we didn't have any problems with him. There was no problem on the set. The actor just was unhappy with the director of his character, direction of his character. And so that's why they killed off Hafsack on the show. And then the actor kind of spiraled after that. Anyway, to get off of that depressing thing and back on, the club dynamic has always been the older guys give the younger guys a really hard time. And it's like a really crappy older brother, younger brother type relationship. Or if you're Juice, you're always looking for father figures. And Chibs was his number one father figure.
Okay, so speaking of father figures,
mm-hmm.
you know, we had talked about it slightly, which was the idea, and especially in your notes, the mm-hmm. idea of Jax getting insight and leadership skills from
Pope,
and now
mm-hmm.
And now Marx is like his, you know, surrogate stepbrother.
I'm glad you said brother, because I think that the Pope Marx relationship was definitely father son.
Definitely. Absolutely.
The reason I love that the show included it is because it seemed like the Pope organization and the Pope Marx relationship was almost like, this is what a healthy criminal organization, this is what a healthy criminal organization looks like, and this is how it works. Whereas you bunch of bikers are so messed up in the head and the feels that it's never going to be that way. Because, you know, Jax and Clay had a deeply, profoundly twisted relationship. You know, there's that primal sin at the heart of it, and that always stained it. What I wonder is if Marx is gunning for Jax because he's figured out. I mean, he kind of knew that something wasn't right with the way Damon Pope was killed.
Right.
But he was forced to go along with, you know, yes, right, it was Clay. We'll take care of Clay in prison, whatever. Oh, how convenient, you're in charge, Jax. Like, I think he knew that there was something fishy about the way that went down. And then you have a character who basically says, I bide my time and I wait for the facts to roll in and I only move when it's good for me. And I really feel like, again, that was the character turning to the audience and going, look, everyone, I've broadcast my modus operandi. I'm gunning for Jax now.
That's not, I mean, that is not a crazy idea at all.
No.
At this point,
the list of people who want to kill Jax is much, much longer than the list of people who want to keep him alive.
Well, and I really cannot figure out this motivation to, like, just scourge and basically throw the monkey wrench into Yellow's mm-hmm. action.
Okay, you read my recap, good news, listeners, The Incomparable is going to start hosting Sons of Anarchy recaps written by me. They're not going to be as long as they were on Television Without Pity, but they are going to tell you what went on in the show and float a few critical observations and or theories. Anyway, I don't get why Jax thinks that the Lynn triad killed his wife. Like, there is literally nothing about that makes any sense whatsoever, and the reception among everyone he's talked to seems to indicate that hunting down a biker's old lady and killing her is a shocking breach of criminal etiquette. And my one, and this is again the tinfoil hat theory. My one tinfoil hat theory is that Jax has finally gone around the bend to the point where he's like, you know what? The only way I get out of this life is if I do destroy the club, destroy my mother, and burn this mother to the ground. And so I'm going to pretend to go along with my mom's crazy scheme because it will keep her off my back. And I'm going to destroy the club from the inside out. They'll follow me because these doofuses will follow anybody with a president's patch. And I'm going to lead them into the end of the world because, you know,
that's the only way. And that brings up a great point, is because now he's starting to get blowback.
Mm-hmm.
And with the meeting at Indian Hills.
Yeah.
That's going to come back to haunt him, because what did they do? They killed the two guys that Indian Hills brought in.
Yeah.
And it's easy.
Jury's reaction suggests that either there is like a father, there's some sort of father-son type connection there, or something else going on, because they made a very deliberate parallel between the way Jury was holding that man and crying over him and the way Jax was holding his son and weeping at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, look, so it could be Marx. And mm-hmm. it could even be Jury.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think again, we're setting up How many different people want to kill Jax?
Oh, who doesn't want to kill him at this point? That might be a shorter list. And I think it probably includes Gemma, and that might be about it.
That might be the only one.
Yeah. But she's already shown that she's capable of killing her children because she killed Tara, whom she thought of as a daughter.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, like, I want to hate this character so badly because, again, she's poison. She ruins everything she touches. And, you know, she's set to ruin a third generation of men just based on her ridiculous adherence to the club. And yet she goes and she has those stupid scenes where she tears up talking about how she's always known Tara was an angel. And you can tell it's genuine emotion. And the only kind of emotion she's going to allow herself to show because it's around a child. So she feels safe. And I'm all, oh, why are you making me feel things for you? Why can't I just hate you uncritically? But I can't. I think the character is incredibly layered and fascinating, and all credit to that goes to Katie Sagal.
Well, and here's the other thing as I'm thinking is, you mm-hmm. know, Nero is giving out, you know, he is trying to be as truthful as he possibly can be.
Yes.
And she makes this statement, and I swear to you she's made it twice in both mm-hmm. episodes, which is a truth that fits.
Yes.
Or a truth that works.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's that element of what is real truth and what is the truth that fits at that particular time that will get me to the next thing that I need to do.
Yeah, what's expedient?
And could it be that maybe even Nero would mm-hmm. maybe kill Gemma? It's not inconceivable because, you know, obviously we haven't gotten to that point because people are going to start getting clipped off like flies.
Yeah. The thing that – if we head to the death pool, I'm going to guess that Juice dies sometime in the next four episodes. Just because either he'll do it by his own hand or he'll get killed by, someone in the Mayans of the Triad who thinks that he's still active with the club and is not up to date on all the interpersonal squabbles going on. But either way, Juice is done. He's just a dead man walking. What I'm having fun trying to figure out is who else is going to get killed this season and who's going to live.
I mean, I think, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's so hard for me to wager on that because mm-hmm. it, at this point, it literally could be anybody and it could happen even as early as episode 3, we could have the first clip.
Yeah. Well, we all know Jax has to stay alive until the finale.
I mean, that's the only way that can work.
Yeah. Although, you know, it would be novel if he were killed off early and then the last episode is just everybody discovering how badly he screwed them over.
Or we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Oh, crap. But
can I just say that this whole bringing up with the with the new sheriff, was like, you know, when it just seems so oddball.
Yeah, I have sheriff fatigue. This is what, the fourth we've had.
Yeah, you know, I almost wish they would have brought back that guy from season 2. Like, I actually enjoyed that character so much.
Yeah. But I can't be bothered to care about her because this sounds terrible. At this point, we're playing out the clock. There's 11 episodes left, and that's going to be, what, 22 hours, given the way Sutter writes?
I think that's
16? I don't know.
Right, but that's what makes me so mad. It's like you cannot throw away an episode at this point. You cannot have just throwaways.
I think it's furniture moving. I think what they did is they established – okay, here are the things I think they established in this episode. I think they established that Gemma has decided Unser's out. Like, she saw the folder. She is going to do everything she can to make his job harder. So we've established that the Gemma-Unser relationship is severed. He just doesn't know it yet. We've established that Unser has basically put himself on the side of good, and I put good in quotation marks. But you know, he's going to be like a dog on a bone with this case. And while I found it to be interesting that he's holding his cards close to the vest when it comes to Juice, I wonder if that's him being tactical as opposed to him being loyal. Because I think at this point his loyalty is just to himself, or it's to the idea that he needs to leave a legacy. I think we established that. like you said, Nero is going to be a politician. I think we've established that there is literally nobody in Northern California who doesn't want to kill Jax at this point. I think we've established that Jax has turned into like a mass murderer and is beginning to make mistakes because he doesn't know as much as he thinks he knows. And to that, I point to Jerry and the two guys Jax thought he was tying off a loose end with those two guys. What he's actually done is given himself a bigger problem because there's going to be mutiny in the charters by the end of the series. I think we've established that Juice is dead man walking. And I think we've established that morale in the club is kind of to the point where they're like, look, I have no idea what's going on. I'm just going along with it. Boom. End of story. Like, everybody seems really joyless these days. You know, even the funny routines aren't that funny. Like, the closest they got was the beginning where Tig is horribly insulting Rat Boy's parents and vice versa. And I thought, well, this is almost like season one, but there's a... Like, the thing that made me fall in love with the show in season one was how funny it was and how these guys unrepentantly enjoyed their life. And in terms of show chronology, we're only 3.5 years from where we started, but these guys all look and act like a decade older. And who can blame them?
Right. I mean, they've been through so very much.
Most of it's self-inflicted.
True. I mean, and look, Tiggs has watched his daughter burn. You would think that he would be, you know, he'd be a little more like somber, but I'm willing to accept that because he's kind of a psycho.
I read an interview with Kim Coates where he actually worked with a couple psychologists before he shot the scene where he watches his daughter burn, and he's like, "I really need you to walk me through the process of how my character would react, and explain the psychological breakdown because I need it to be work that I can draw on for the rest of the series." And the way the actor understands his character is that Tig is a soldier. He's not a strategist. He's not a leader. He's somebody who's very good at following orders and very comfortable when somebody's giving orders.
Which almost is like perfect for his affection for the dog, as in Tig is the dog.
Oh, he is. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And... And I think the thing is in addition to grieving his daughter, he's also grieving Clay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he loved this guy. And he loved Gemma. Like, in seasons 2 and 3, it's really evident that in some ways the entity of Clay and Gemma was kind of the big love of his life.
Well, yeah, and I always thought that eventually Tig and Gemma were going to get together.
No, she was playing him. She always was playing him. Like, there's that scene in... season 2, where they almost have sex, like up against the wall, and then he notices the photo album, the photos of her and her kids, and he stops because he's like, I really can't even do this to you. And it's not because it's wrong with him and Gemma. He stops because he can't bear the thought of being the disruptive force in that family.
And loyalty.
Yeah. And then in season 3, when they all meet up again at Gemma's dad's house, you know, Clay comes out and Tig's all, oh my God, thank God you're finally here. You know? So like I said, I think Clay and Gemma were the big love of his life, like put together. And, you know, he's always looking for missing pieces of some sort of nuclear family. Like, he couldn't make one of his own, but he wants to be in somebody else's.
Oh boy. Maybe. Yeah. Well, I could see where Tig would flip.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at this point, what does he have to live for? Like, one daughter is estranged and on the run. The other one is burned to death. Clay is dead. Gemma is out of reach in multiple ways. And the club is in the middle of chaos and confusion. You know, I could easily see him, unless he gets to either a Venus Van Damme, which possibility, you know, I can't really see him having much to live for.
For me, that would be great. To see them walk them down the aisle. It would just be an awesome, hilarious moment.
Oh my God, that'd be the best Sons of Anarchy wedding ever.
It really would. And the thing is, I think that's one thing that this season really does need is that moment, those moments of levity. And this one definitely didn't have it.
This episode was funnier than the first, but that's kind of like saying that chicken pox is better than shingles. It was just, it's unrelentingly bleak, which is understandable in the grand scheme of things because, you know, we're hurtling towards tragedy. This entire series has been a tragedy and we're playing out the back end of it. But at the same time, you know, we're losing some of the things that made this series kind of compelling and watchable. And if somebody had just come in and not been there from the start, or marathon this series from the start, they'd be like, oh my God, this is just, my husband refuses to watch the show because he calls it moral rot. And he's like, they would be like, oh, this is just grim people joylessly killing each other and making speeches, you know?
Well, I mean, that's what, if it doesn't change, like, mm-hmm. by next Tuesday,
yeah,
we're going to have a problem.
Yeah, I hope it. Well, there's 13 episodes. Next week is number 3. Sutter typically writes a season to be 3 to 4 acts, so I think we'll have the last of the furniture arranging next week, and then my prediction is it picks up by episode 4.
Maybe we get a good drop-off on 3. Maybe something kicks it in.
Maybe. I'm not betting on it. I'm betting that next week is another one when you are like, ooh, and then 4 will be the one where we're like, oh, we remember why we love this show.
It's when Opie comes back to life.
Oh, no. Okay, we're already at 31 minutes. We can't possibly get into the Opie question tonight.
All right, that's for another time.
Yes, if next week's episode is excruciating, we may just skip that one and talk about Opie.
we'll just go with we'll go with the 60 seconds, and then it's Opie all times.
Yeah, all Opie, all that Opie's greatest hits. Opie's funniest lines, because you have to, oh, he did, Ryan Hurst has some of the best line readings in the business. Oh, anyway. So guys, we have made it to 32 minutes or so. I thank you for your patience with, this flash cast. Real life intervened, but next week, Philip and I should be on a more prompt and regular schedule. And I look forward to talking to you then. Again, for TV's flash cast of Sons of Anarchy, I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And I'm Phil Moslak.
All right. See you next week.
See you then.
Mona. Right now, you're the only wetback I don't want to see dead.